All right, let's step off together into our third hour tonight. Charlotte Iserbeet is back, and Charlotte has been a guest on this program many times over the last, I don't know how many years now. She has been one of those key players of our lifetimes who have done absolutely invaluable work, heroic work, in putting pieces of the puzzle together so that those of us who care to see can see what's going on, what's being done to us, how it was all planned, how it has been perpetrated, actually brilliantly, by a small but deadly and almost omnipotent group of people who have sought to reshape and rework and remake the world in their own image. We are nothing to them but sheeple, cattle, digits in a computer, however you want to look at it. Charlotte has produced a book called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. Now think about that title, and then think about a small to medium-sized phone book full of documentation, full of proof, not hearsay, full of reality, full of the actual roadmap showing exactly over the last century how we got from a great educational system which produced individuals who were taught to achieve and to excel and to be creative to an educational system which has been turned inside out, which produces bees and hives and people who think for the group and who are so afraid to step out and be different that there doesn't really need to be much policing from the outside anymore, because these poor young people that we have today police themselves out of fear, out of negativity, and in many cases out of ugliness, pornography, drugs, disrespect. There's an anti-intellectual ethic now which is pushing many of our younger people into the abyss from which they will never recover. You can't retrieve someone who has fallen in. You cannot revive or rehabilitate an intellect which was born dead and never developed. It's virtually impossible. And with all that gum beating, let me stop now and say hello to our pal Charlotte. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello, Jeff. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Things are really interesting.
Oh, aren't they?
I just don't know how you get through to the American people. I think I've just about given up.
Well, you've reached all that you... Charlotte, what we have to do is reach that rather shaggy remnant left that's still able to think and cares enough to do so. It's not the majority. It's not a sizable portion, although I will say a sizable portion of the public senses there's something really wrong, but they don't have the intellectual acumen or interest to really pursue it. They've got enough grief and trouble and angst.
I think that's really it. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we've had a few things going on in the family that were difficult, and, you know, my sister's been sick, and I have probably a son. You know, things going on. And then I was having to do some work from some accounting and having spent a lot of time on the book. Book sales have been very good. And I was thinking, I had all these other concerns about the family, and I was having a very hard time being accurate with the book work. And all of a sudden it dawned on me that, you know, Charlotte, this is probably the main reason that we've got this society out there that has this glazed expression. When you mention something to them, they're very important that they should be concerned about politically or economically or whatever. The American people are very good people, but they're so on such overload. Not only do they have husband and wife are both working, they've got to be concerned about their families, the dog that gets sick, they've got to make a mortgage payment. Perhaps they've got a mother-in-law living with them. They've got everything. Maybe someone's really terribly sick with depression. I don't know, but it just dawned on me because I had just a little slice of that particular day, not being able to really do a very good job with the work I had to do because of these concerns. And I thought, well, I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we're unable to inform our good neighbors and good Americans about how very serious the situation is in this country. It's facing our children, facing all of us, facing our economy, facing our moral fiber. you just can't get through. They because they're on overload. I really think that has a great. I'm not trying to make excuses. My other excuse always, you know, is the four-pronged fork that I always talk about, which is how could anybody really resist such a diabolical plan, which has been taking place for over 100 years? And, you know, it's the four-pronged fork, the gradualism, the frog in the cold water. You know, he heats it up gradually, he doesn't even know he's dying.
Right.
The dialectic, where they call, if you want something, the top people, the insiders, we call them the internationalists, if they want something, they create a problem, and then they know that we're going to scream in regard to it, and then they'll impose the solution that they want, which we will accept, because we can't stand the problem. They're that clever. And then you have the semantic deception, where they use very, very familiar words that sound good to us, like basic skills in the schools. We think it's reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's not, you know, basic skills being tolerant, knowing that the Constitution is outmoded, blah, blah, blah. And money, big bucks, money. Now, those four, I call the four-pronged fork, that diabolical scheme that they have, you have to give them incredible credit. I mean, they figured this one out.
Oh, they're brilliant.
Those
sure.
four prongs are enough to capture anybody. Is it any wonder over a period of time, because the gradualism is so vital? And that, too, plus their creation, deliberate. And, you know, there's a very interesting entry in my book in regard, I think it was the White House Conference on Population in 1980, perhaps, or earlier, where it was decided how they were going to get the parents get the mothers out of the home and increase inflation and do all sorts of things with the Federal Reserve in order to get the mothers out of the home so the government could take over. And, you know, so these things have been planned,
yeah.
And it is diabolical because no normal mind operates this way. So we make excuses. And I think we've made enough excuses for them tonight, personally, because then there are the others who, my husband and I were talking about it tonight. He's European. They're bad, too, I can assure you. Things are so bad over there that they don't even worry about it anymore, being stupid. But he was talking about how you cannot get people to listen or be concerned, and that we've just gotten to a point where Americans in particular, I know what he said, I might not say, he said that Americans think they know best because they're Americans.
That's true. I like that.
Yeah, that's good. Only a European could really say that.
Yeah,
you're right.
That's cute. All right, hang on. Be right back with Charlotte Thompson. Is her beat in just a minute. Okay, Charlotte's book has legs, as they say, and well it should, The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, available at deliberatedumbingdown.com. How many have we sold now, do we know?
Well, we're close to 15,000, which is really pretty good.
Wonderful.
For a big book like that.
You bet it is.
And
that's a pass-along book, too. People want to loan that out. It's like a trailer full of evidence is what it is.
Well, yes, it is. It's got all the documents in it, and I love it myself. I pat myself on the back, plus the gals who helped me with it. But facts are facts. Maybe people don't think that's terribly important anymore, but it is, because without history, you're lost. You're absolutely helpless. And
what is it about this culture that has turned its back on history? And the whole idea of learning from history seems somehow to have fallen out of favor. I guess I shouldn't even ask the question. It should be a rhetorical statement.
Yeah, well,
it really is.
I mean, if you go back, you know, in my book, which I always refer to, probably the most important entry, it's not nearly the jazziest, or, you know, some of the entries are so unbelievable, you know, the quotes from educators that are so clearly diabolical, what their plans are at these fancy meetings they hold, like the one the chief state school officers held in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, you know, about 20 years ago. Those are the real juicy ones that you get into, and you can just see the wine glasses clinking and looking out on the gorgeous Tetons, and there they are meeting with all the top insiders, the CFR people and Willard Wirtz, and planning the destruction of our education. That's the sort of one that really is very yummy. But then the cut-and-dried Carnegie Corporation 1934 conclusions and recommendations for the social studies, which is just what you asked me, huh? History, conclusions, and well, what are they talking about? Recommendations for social studies. Well, exactly what you just were saying. Get rid of American history. Change it. We don't want the children to grow up knowing that we have a Bill of Rights or a Constitution or that there was an American Revolution, who George Washington was, blah, et cetera, et cetera. They're very clever because if our children don't know that, and as I always say, when it's taken away from them, when their economic system is taken away, political system, whatever, they won't know, because you never know something's taken away from you if you don't know you have it in the first place. And that particular document, which really called for a socialist America, and it was considered that way by leading professors, they even came out and said this is a call for a socialist America. It said there that we'll just use the schools to change America from a free, this is a direct quote, free individualistic economy to a planned socialist economy in the new order. And not new world order, new order. And from that time on, Carnegie, along with many other of the tax-exempt foundations, but Carnegie's the easiest one to follow, used because it was consistent. I mean, a lot of people might say, oh, well, Charlotte, that was just a document in 1934. And I say, yeah, you just follow their tracks all the way through every single year. For instance, 1945 with Alger Hiss, a communist, most instrumental in putting us under the communist United Nations. And then in 1969, the funding of the National Assessment, which is now mandatory under the No Child Left Behind, 60% of which is
yep.
politically correct.
Yep.
And you can just keep going on. Then there's so many of them, but 1985, when Ronald Reagan signed the agreements with Gorbachev, who, of course, is a major communist, admits to it still, although Americans think communism is dead. But when Reagan signed those agreements, merging the two education systems, you had in the background another agreement between the Carnegie Corporation and the Soviet Academy of Science, which really was even more significant, I believe, because it dealt with computer-assisted instruction in critical thinking for the early elementary years, where you have to go to the Soviets for that, folks. So then you move on, and I think most of your listeners out there who've been fighting outcomes-based education and the Skinner Method and the school-to-work agenda are fully aware that it was basically a Carnegie Corporation operation with Mark Tucker of Carnegie starting out in Rochester, New York, and the Plan for Education and the Economy, which, of course, will implement the Soviet polytech system, the Cuban system or East German, whatever you want to call it, where the government, in partnership with the private sector, that's part of the Communist Manifesto, by the way. In that partnership, they determine how many doctors, janitors, lawyers, et cetera, are necessary, and there's no freedom whatsoever for the individuals and no upward mobility whatsoever. So anyway, Carnegie is the best one to look at. One could probably do fairly well striking out with the Ford Foundation or the Pew or whatever, the tax exempts. But the plan was there, and they have carried it out, and it is based on what Norman Dodd was told in 1953 as research director for the committee investigating the tax-exempt foundation. He was told, and I knew Norman Dodd, wonderful patriot, wonderful man, and he was told by the president of the Ford Foundation that that was exactly the plan, verbatim. Rowan Gaither said, "Mr. Dodd, we get our instructions from the White House."
Yeah. Hold on a sec. We'll take a little break, come right back. And it's all in the book, The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America by Charlotte Thompson Iserbeet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, welcome back. Talking with Charlotte Isherbeet, whose columns and articles and essays have popped up on the net for quite some time. And we have, thanks to her, an absolutely lock in terms of understanding how it was done and who did it. And that it is the subversion, the subjugation of the American government school system to create what we're seeing now, which are, I don't want to say dim bulbs because some of them aren't lit up at all, but they're not very bright. And, you know, here's another thing. You know, this no child left behind thing. A lot of parents whose kids have grown now or who don't have kids or maybe young couples who don't have children, they take tests now in high school. This is a true story. And they fail the test. They get a B. They get a, it doesn't matter. Any questions they miss on the test, they are allowed to go back into class, open book, and retake the parts of the test that they have failed or gotten incorrect. There is no accountability.
None.
No responsibility. You don't have to study because you can go back and take the test again with the book open to pass the class. You see, no child left behind. And the teachers will tell you, well, they're learning in any case because they have to go back and go over the information. So they're still learning. They don't get it. There's such a thing as accountability, responsibility, and reward for effort expended. But not anymore. They're cutting the legs out from under all the kids who actually do the work, who will logically say, why the hell should I have to study anymore, really, when I'm not held accountable, when I can go back and take the test next week and get an A on it, even if I get a D, it doesn't matter. That's what's going on. You know it, and a lot of our listeners know it. This is actually true. So in addition to that, many of the children now, and they are children, 12, 14, 15, in high school classes, will curse the teachers, tell the teachers to this four-letter words, and the teachers don't do anything about it. Nothing. And when I ask these students, well, when you talk about the teachers like they're tell the teachers to go to hell or whatever, what do? They don't care. And the other thing is, when I saw this trend toward, you remember when the teachers in the 70s and 80s began to encourage the students to call me by my first name?
Oh, yeah.
That was a big indicator to me that it was on the way out. It's gone now, folks.
That's right.
They curse the teachers. They demean the teachers. Now, some teachers won't allow it. I know you listening out there who are teachers who won't permit that. That's fine. But many of your colleagues do. And word gets around instantaneously that there is no respect for this teacher, there is no discipline, and furthermore, there are no consequences. That's what your schools are doing today.
Oh, yeah, it's pathetic. I think for those who really don't understand what the No Child Left Behind Act is all about, there's an excellent little booklet that was written by a researcher friend of mine from Arizona, and we've put it on my website free, and it's called All Children Left Behind.
There you go.
And there's no excuse for anybody not to understand it. All the legislation is there. It's explained clearly. It's got extraordinary footnotes and documentation. Right up to this minute, folks, it tells you exactly what that legislation will mean for your children and their futures and your children's friends and our country, basically. And it, as you were just saying, Jeff, the moral aspect is absolutely frightening, what's going on in the schools now. And but that was pretty much all planned, and although, you know, we have very little time tonight, but I often think that I discussed the fact that it wasn't just the academic chaos that was planned. It was the moral chaos. And let's get it straight, folks. It was planned by the Soviets. What we're talking about is a total plan by communism. And the internationalists, of course, paid for the Soviet Union, so you can pull in Wall Street and see how this is terrible. It's really a shame to have to talk about our fine capitalistic system this way, but they paid for the creation of the Soviet Union. They have managed to keep it alive. There are books out there that are terribly, terribly important in that regard, and I do mention them in the back of my book. One is certainly Anthony Sutton's magnificent book on Skull and Bones,
yeah.
which was the Order, and that discusses how the Yale students went to Germany and became very knowledgeable about the shift, the change from education to behavior modification, where in education the child is considered a human being. In training, behavior modification, the child is an animal. That came out of Germany. Pavlov, interestingly enough, went to Germany to study under Wilhelm Wundt. And so that had to happen, where the child is considered an animal, not a human being, and all the curriculum and all the behavior modification is based on that. And communism is based on that. And if you look at the system, it sort of makes sense from the standpoint of those at the top, the elite, who want to use our children as human resources. Of course, that is what they've been planning that for years, and that is why they have supported the Soviet system. The Soviet system, everybody was told, had collapsed and was dead. No, it's completely alive. It was a total fraud. The wall never came down, basically. Communism didn't go away. It just went under. It goes through these periods of going under, and then it gets more money from us, et cetera. It's just another thing. And this is all written about, clearly documented, in Perestroika Deception by Anatoly Golitsyn. Mm-hmm. And everybody should get that book.
One of the most
well.
Important books of the last quarter century.
Yeah. Absolutely. So the proof is there. But there is one document that a lot of people don't have, and I really should retype it and get it on my website, and it is a speech that was given by Lavrenty Beria, the Bolshevik psychopolitician and head of the Soviet secret police, in 1936 to American students at Lenin University. And he talks there about changing loyalties through psychopolitics. It's incredible how to use mental health. And, of course, we've got the Bush administration with the screening for all of us now. That should scare us to death. But the use of mental health, and I'm just going to read a few things because it's quite lengthy. But
yeah, hold on, Charlotte. Let's read that right
when,
after
when
this.
We come back.
Please.
Okay.
And we'll do that now. And
come back.
Right back. With Charlotte Thompson Iserbeet in just a couple minutes. And I have more to say about the high schools after she reads these examples. We'll do that as we roll along into our next segment, just a couple minutes. All right, Charlotte, let's hear some of those quotes.
Yeah, they're incredible. I can't read all of them, but some, just to give you an idea. This is the former head of the Soviet secret police under Stalin, really a brutal guy, and he was the Bolshevik psychopolitician. And psychopolitics is the art of asserting and maintaining, this is him talking, dominion over the thoughts and loyalties and the effecting of the conquest of enemy nations through mental healing. And he was giving the speech to American students in 1936 at Lenin University. Okay, and it's incredible because everything that he talked about has happened, has been carried out in this country. And he goes here, he says, in rearranging loyalties, we must have command of their values. And because they consider our children animals, all the way through, he mentions animals, okay. In the animal, the first loyalty is to himself. This is destroyed by demonstrating errors to him, showing him that he does not remember, cannot act, or does not trust himself. The second loyalty is to his family unit, his parents and brothers and sisters. This is destroyed by making a family unit economically non-dependent, by lessening the value of marriage, by making an easiness of divorce, and by raising the children wherever possible by the state. Under the saccharine guise of assistance to them, the child can be driven in his teens into revolt. Yeah. Delinquency will ensue. By making readily available drugs of various kinds, by giving the teenager alcohol, by praising his wildness, by stimulating him with sex literature and advertising to him or her practices as taught at the sex poll, the psychopolitical operator can create the necessary attitude of chaos, idleness, and worthlessness into which can then be cast the solution which will give the teenager complete freedom everywhere.
Gee, what year was this?
This is 1936.
Oh, man.
Goes
to a
on
T.
And says, should it be possible to continue conscription, think about the war in Iraq, huh, beyond any reasonable time by promoting unpopular wars and other means, the draft, which is coming, can always stand as a further barrier to the progress of youth in life, destroying any immediate hope to participate in his nation's civil life. If we could effectively kill the national pride and patriotism of just one generation, we will have won that country. Therefore, there must be continual propaganda abroad to undermine the loyalty of the citizens in general and the teenager in particular. The role of the psychopolitical operator in this is very strong. He can, from his position as an authority on the mind, advise all manner of destructive measures. He can teach the lack of control of this child at home. He can instruct in an optimum situation the entire nation in how to handle children and instruct them so that the children, given no control, given no real home, can run wildly about with no responsibility for their nation or themselves. And then I won't go on much more, but I'll just read one more. Constant pressure in the legislature of the United States can bring about legislation to the effect that every student attending a high school or university must have classes in psychology. And then we had to destroy, after many, many years of the most arduous work, the church. So we must destroy all faiths in nations marked for conquest. We have battled in America since the century's turn to bring to nothing any and all Christian influences, and we are succeeding. Now, this was published in the Congressional Record March 11, 1969.
Yeah.
It's terribly important because that's exactly what they've done. And I keep saying that this is the communist system. This is the atheist communist system where man is considered nothing but an animal. And there's my book, as you know, Jeff, about a third of it probably does deal with animal training, operant conditioning, behavior modification, and the fact that it's being used constantly. It's just all the time we see it now, not just in the schools, but as I mentioned to you before, in our own community, the police are handing out little coins,
yeah.
You know, medals,
merit things,
for citizens who do good deeds as determined by the police. And let me make another point. You're probably aware of this, too, that Marcus Wolf, I think that's his name, the East German Stasi head, has now been hired by the Department of Homeland Security to set up internal security here. And to probably 4%, I understand, of the East German population was recruited to spy on other East Germans. He was very involved in that. This is what we're going to be under, folks. I know you think that I am absolutely crazy when I say that, but I have heard that from two independent sources. And not only Marcus Wolf, but other East Germans are being taken on as consultants to Homeland Security by the Bush administration. And if you don't know what the Stasi is, my husband said they probably won't know that. They'll think it's some kind of spaghetti. The Stasi was the most violent, brutal, effective, efficient internal security operation apparatus that ever was developed, more so than the German system, more so than the KGB. So we're just warning you, we're warning all of you out there that this incredible system is being implemented right this minute.
It is, and whether you want to call it communism or whatever you want to call it, it doesn't matter, because it's a pathogen of the worst kind.
Ism. It's an ism, and we're not an ism.
No. Another couple notes on the schools, and I was a high school teacher. I taught high school in Santa Barbara for a couple of years.
You did. I didn't know that. You would have been a great teacher.
Well,
yeah.
I lasted 2 years and you know, left for more productive pursuits.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The kids now pretty much run the high schools. The teachers are afraid of them. Mm-hmm. They look the other way at drug use on campus. They look the other way at antisocial, aberrant behavior. They don't want to get involved. I'm not saying I thoroughly blame them, but if they're going to be a teacher, they better learn to be a total teacher, not just a teacher of convenience.
Right.
The students, by and large, now have been relegated and brought down through the music and the so-called pop culture to a pretty primitive, primal, pecking order kind of existence in the school. This is back out in the trees. This is the toughest rule. It's a power, an animal power kind of a thing. The weakest run. There are exceptions, but this is a generality, which is very appropriate and very correct. These are not happy-go-lucky kids anymore.
No.
The pressure is ruthless. They want to fight. They live in this virtual world half the time where they're blowing people away on their video screens. Yep. The music is telling them to hate, demean, and abuse the opposite sex in many cases, and on and on. It is a horrible situation. The administrators, for the most part, are spineless, yellow-bellied losers who don't want any trouble from anybody, least of all an unhappy parent whose child is suspended for a couple of days for doing something utterly inappropriate, because the parent will go to the Board of Education or threaten a lawsuit. So the students run the school, backed up by parents in many cases who would never back an administrator under any circumstance. My kid didn't do anything wrong.
It's cruel. It's absolutely cruel what's been done to our children. But for anybody to think that it's just a mistake, no. And you know what? This kind of education, in quotes, is horribly expensive. Behavior modification, horribly expensive.
Well, it starts out in the government schools and ends up in the government prisons. And we pay from the beginning to the end.
Yep.
Thank you, Charlotte. Great to talk with you.
Always, and I hope you have a very Merry Christmas. That's, I guess, politically incorrect, huh?
It's all right. Let's be incorrect. You too.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
All right, good night.
And I'll talk to you after the beginning of the wonderful next new year we're going to have. Let's hope we will. God help all of us.
Indeed. Take care.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye, Jeff.
Good night. Okay, Charlotte Thompson Iserbeet, all demonstrably factual, everything we've just said. Okay, we'll pause for 21 hours and see you tomorrow.